cut back on fact-checking, leaving communities vulnerable to misinformation. In this time of social crisis and climate emergencies, local stations provide vital information for keeping our community safe. You can help by supporting and donating to your local community media. This message comes to you in solidarity from the Pacifica Foundation.
Hi, this is Sally Kirkland, and you're listening to KPFK, radio powered by the people, fiercely independent, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. Today we're going to look at two moments separated by more than a century that both reveal the clash between imperial ambitions and the right of nations to determine their own fate. In our first segment, we turn to Alaska, where Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin are meeting face to face. What's on the table between the U.S. and Russia, and what might this summit mean for Ukraine and the broader geopolitical balance in the world? Is this Munich, Alaska? And then in the second half, we step back in time with my guest, historian and activist Vladislav Starovoutsev, to revisit a pivotal chapter in Ukraine's history that has been buried for decades, the Ukrainian People's Republic of 1917 to 1923. This short-lived but visionary democratic socialist republic was forged in the revolutionary upheavals of 1905, World War I, and the 1917 Russian Revolution. It did not last, and its history is tied to the larger story of revolution, civil war, and defeat. Its story of resistance, progressive reform, and anti-imperialist struggle still resonates in Ukraine's fight today. So two moments, past and present, both offering lessons in power and the future of democracy and, of course, self-determination. All this when our program returns in just a moment. And welcome back to Beneath the Surface. We are going to be speaking to Vladislav Starobutsev today about two different moments for Ukraine and indeed for the world. Today, as you know, there are talks in Alaska between Trump and Putin without Zelensky present. These talks have enormous stakes for Ukraine today, but the clash between Russian power and Ukrainian self-determination is not just a story for the 21st century. It also goes back more than 100 years to the revolutionary era when Ukraine tried to chart its own socialist democratic course. And we're going to be looking at that whole story, but beginning with Alaska. Vladislav Starobutsev is a Ukrainian left-wing activist. He has been on this show before, and we talked a lot about the developing invasion of Ukraine, full-scale invasion. And he's also an historian of Central Eastern Europe, and he's currently a soldier in the Ukrainian Armed Forces as this war continues. So I want to welcome you to the program, Vladislav. And let's begin right away with what's at stake. In this summit between Putin and Trump without Zelensky, it's in process as we are speaking, so we don't know the outcome of it. But we know even before it began that there were very low expectations for any progress on ending the war in Ukraine, because we also know that Putin is not interested in ending the war in Ukraine. And for him, it's already a win just to be there and to be in Alaska, which is also a kind of interesting contested territory because there are those Russian nationalists who want Alaska back. So starting with that, let's look at this and how you see it. Is it a photo op? Is it a win for Putin? How do you see it?
Yes, thank you for a great introduction. And I think it's in some way a kind of old KGB joke about hosting a summit in Alaska and also at the same time of giving the medal to the son of the CIA leader in the US. It's kind of extremely nationalist in its form. Even without the context, it's something that Russia would use for its propaganda purposes and already starts quite strong. And at the same time, from US side, we are seeing that even people on Fox and people connected to the Trump administration report on kind of nonsensical nature of these negotiations. They told that practically the only purpose of them for Trump to see Putin in person and to understand what he is as a person, not by speaking on mobile phone, but personal. So there is not even a clear agenda, not even clear understanding, but more of kind of childish approach of Trump to diplomacy. I wouldn't say even at this moment that it is a surrender of Ukraine or anything, but just Trump having thoughts and conceptions how to approach diplomatic relations, changing every few minutes and playing real time without any strategy. And it seems that it is precisely what's going on. This meeting has nothing to gain for US, for Russia, and especially for Ukraine. Has little sense at all. There certainly wouldn't be any major progress there, because what could possibly be discussed that wasn't. And at the same time, it is also legitimation of Russia, especially considering that Putin is a war criminal that wasn't visiting foreign countries. I think he visited Mongolia and Azerbaijan, probably. I don't remember, but he visited only allied nations or the nations that practically were forced to host him. And it is a first major visit to practically powers that not directly aligned with Russia, that could continue Russian diplomatic isolation, but decided to legitimize horrible war criminal on the international sphere. So that's kind of what's going on right now. I don't know how it will develop. Probably it is a first step to some kind of negotiation between Ukraine and Russia. Probably for some kind of pause in the war, for resupplying for both of the forces and for preparing maybe for the second part of the war later in some time, for restructuring of the armies. Or maybe just a move to take attention away or to try to limit sanctions or even negotiate some kind of reintroduction of Russia to global economy.
Well, let me come in there because there's a whole lot to unpack, and we'll come back to more of your overall summary of what's going on. Trump has already come under great criticism for doing this summit, and especially for sidelining Zelensky, which is absolutely absurd. But he described this as a kind of feel-out meeting and also floated the idea of a land swap. We'll talk about that in a minute. But it's a very real estate solution, and that's what Trump is, who believes that he can always make deals and it doesn't really matter. As long as there is a deal, he feels like he's had a success. But this plays into Putin's hands, and I want to ask you how you think it does and what you think Putin's actual objective is here. It seems really doubtful that he's looking for a kind of substantive deal on Ukraine unless he can secure U.S. support for his own and Russia's broader geopolitical goals. So I wonder how you see that. We also know, just bringing into that, that Putin has a lot of experience in manipulation and symmetry, and there's many who see this as his playing Trump. And that's, you know, we've had other experiences, including the Helsinki meeting in 2018. So I'm really asking you a question, I guess, about how you see Putin in this conversation and how he sees, is trying to steer it to his own advantage.
Yeah, annexation of Ukraine or even destruction of Ukrainian identity is still main goal of Putin, and Russia wouldn't stop, at least at this form, at this moment. But also there are a lot of medium to short term things that could happen in the, at this moment. There could be indeed some peace that wouldn't be lasting, but that would be used for regrouping, repurposing, rearming, and so on and so on. There could be a push for getting off the sanctions or new trade agreements between Russia and US. It could go in this direction. It could mean some small compromises for reintroduction of Russia on global markets. It has a lot of ways how it could develop, and most of them are benefiting the Russians. And the idea of land swap It's practically right now just a propaganda tool. And
did you just say the land swap is the
yes.
propaganda tool? Right.
Yeah,
okay.
for Russia. They're proposing absolutely insane deal of so-called swap of land, where they just demand Ukrainian lands where the most fortified areas of the front line for practically no gains for Ukrainian side. No advantages, nothing. We are speaking about around 300,000 people and the strongest fortified area on whole borderline. And this deal just would mean creating positions for Russia to just continue the war even further.
Let me just come in right there on one part of it, because even bringing up the idea of land swaps without having Zelensky at the table to discuss this is, you know, objectionable. But it's also impossible. It's impossible even for the United States. And the deal, the earlier deal that Trump tried to conclude with Zelensky, which would give the U.S. some access or rights to the mineral, to the rare earth minerals that lie, and in fact, in the occupied areas. So this is very important, of course, to Putin, because he would like to have those rare earth minerals. And Putin seems to think that any place that a Russian, you know, that the Russian army has encroached, that that's already their part. But I think it's worth telling our audience that, in fact, the gains of Russia this year, which are real, are small. And that even though most of the maps that they show that now Russia controls 20% of Ukrainian territory, they have managed to gain, what, something like 1% in this last year, and at a cost of 1 million casualties overall for Russia. Maybe we could just use that as the kind of frame to talk about this issue of, one, territorial concessions, and two, how meaningless this is without Zelensky at the table.
Exactly. It's practically a propaganda tool, because nothing could be accepted in terms of any land swaps in US between Russian and US president, because what they need to actually force Ukrainian soldiers out of this land for the any land swap to happen. And it won't happen because, as I already said, it is one of the most fortified area that there is on the border. It's just practically a way to have better narrative and image in the media discussing all of this land swap, and of course shows the approach of Trump that is far more suited and far more comfortable for him to speak with dictators and far-right leaders and not with democratically elected governments, countries that fights in defensive war. But yeah, the situation is that the question of land swap is placed in such context that it doesn't guarantee any peace, but rather continuation of war. Putin exactly wants the fortified areas for what? Not to have some substantial peace, even in this compromised way, but for continuing to having like platform to invade further Ukrainian land. So even this land swap creates even less foundations for some kind of compromise deal. So it's absolutely absurd deal. Nobody seriously discusses it. No, not Russian side, and I don't think even US side. It's just something that is flown around practically for the media.
You know, if there is some sort of, as you mentioned, momentary pause or, you know, a ceasefire, you know, for a little while, how do you see that in the larger picture? Because it is Trump and Zelensky who want the war to end. Putin does not want the war to end. And so there's an asymmetry between the goals. And as you mentioned, you know, further sanctions will probably mean very little, because sanctions tend to hurt civilians and ordinary people more than elites or certainly the Russian leadership. They just figure out a way to make it more comfortable for themselves. And so they're pretty much ineffective, except in a propaganda way, as you said, another symbolic way. What would it mean to have a kind of short-term truce? Sorry?
Yeah, it's not really the case for the sanctions, because there was actually a good discussion of Trump pushing for the secondary sanctions against India. And I don't think it is right to portray the sanctions is against civilians, because most of the Russian war economy spends on wages, including for civilian personals on the military factories, and so on and so on. So even for the people who are not, for example, directly in the military, but in the manufacturing sector, it's huge sums of money that is just for paying wages. So even cutting just monetary financial gains of Russian production would mean that they would need to make some cuts in their military production and at the same time in terms of their manufacturing and army. So right now, all the sanctions works. Of course, they are more effective, less effective. Some sanctions direct on the, for example, different manufacturing of electronic components and so on, which are relatively easy to sanction, but they also far complicate the production of weaponry in Russia and make it far more expensive. Also, there are general sanctions, mostly on oil, that makes it harder for Russia to pay wages. Mm-hmm. And for Russia, I think one of the reasons that it is actually forced to even discuss some kind of temporary peace is because it suffered extreme casualties. It lost so much tanks, it lost so much people. And for every person, Russia pays dividends for their families. So it's a lot of spending that...
Let me ask you on that, too. Sorry to interrupt. But you know, this is a very important point because Russia has been able to recruit people to go into, you know, literally to become cannon fodder and to die. But only because their family... And especially because they've recruited from poor areas.
Exactly,
and,
yes.
And in the former republics, that this has been a financial sacrifice in order to help the family, but they sacrifice the husband, brother, father, uncle in the war, and then they get paid something. But as, you know, Russia has amped up its military production and is losing so much, as you say, they're less able to pay these dividends. And so the only other way to do conscription is through coercion, through force. And we already have in the United States an example of what it means, you know, to have an army that doesn't want to fight in Vietnam, and it creates a big anti-war movement. Now, it's much more difficult in repressive Russia, where you can't even say war without being sanctioned and perhaps, I don't mean sanctioned, detained and perhaps thrown into a penal colony. So what does that really mean in terms of the war? And related to that, let's say there is, you know, a temporary truce. How do you see that for both Ukraine and Russia? Does it give Ukraine time to regroup? Or the same for Russia? Do you see it as any just a short-term thing or something that could lead to an end to the war?
I think Russia is extremely scary of thinking of possible peace because it means that it would need to demobilize its army and all of these people who were used as cannon fodder would come home, which would be great political turmoil. But also continuing means that in one moment they would need to go for open mobilization. Right now, they're practically on contractual basis. It's kind of voluntary army, not really, but... and going for more open mobilization would also mean for Russia more spending, more turmoil, and more problems. So both of the directions have negative sides for Russia and problems. The Russian leadership probably would wait and making these decisions. A pause in the conflict really would allow Russia to build more rockets, build more drones. Maybe it would loosen some sanctions, which would help Russian industrial military complex and finances, and in general could prepare Russian war machine. But in some way it works very similar for Ukraine. Ukraine in this scenario of truce would use this time to build fortification along all of the front line, to build some defensive position, to build production, because it's really hard to build production under constant rocket fires. So even some short-time ceasefires would mean that both sides would use this time for military buildup. And both sides of the armies also in need of reform, Ukraine more than Russia, because Russia fights in very barbaric ways when you don't care about your soldiers. There's not really a problem about military structure because you don't need to care much about what soldier thinks. Ukrainian army tend to survive longer, and it means that there are so much more bureaucratic procedures and so on, and chain of command need to be reformed to effectively fight Russia for future. So there are reasons that both sides could exploit this pause, but also there are reasons for which both sides could be reasonably afraid to take it. The biggest risk for Ukraine is that Russia rebuilds stronger and faster than Ukraine. So even if there would be some temporary ceasefire, it would be just race to improve their position while they can.
Let me just ask you finally, because we want to move into the historical segment, Vladislav, but it's clear that Putin is looking at this as a long war. He's prepared to fight for decades, and he doesn't care about the losses, and he doesn't really care about losing wealth either. He cares about power, and he cares about staying in power. And as we mentioned earlier, Zelensky was not part of this of these talks, nor was Europe, and Europe is a very important partner in this. So, and I want to ask you to kind of answer this in two ways. First, to talk about what your own experience has been, and talk about like what it means to be a left-wing socialist fighting for the survival of your country, even if you disagree with the sort of direction and leadership of the country. And then how you see this on the Russian side and Europe's role. It's a gigantic question, but I think a good way to sort of end this segment.
Yeah, I would say that there's a question of leadership and there is a question of national survival or survival of the people. That it's separate questions, and you could criticize your leadership, and you're not going into the fight for your leadership. It's not like it was in the Soviet Union, where people were saying for Stalin, and so on and so on, and where the political commissars demanding some kind of ideological, political loyalty. In situation of Ukraine, it's a question of survival, and it's really a popular war of whole Ukrainian nation against Russian aggressor, because it wouldn't be only bad for Ukrainian leaders if Ukraine loses. It would mean catastrophe for all of us, no matter our social class or political positions and so on and so on. So because of it, there are people of very different political beliefs and very different positions on terms of Ukrainian government that are fighting in this war. And the Ukrainian government are undeniably corrupt, oligarchic, and there were protests recently on this topic to make government at least somewhat accountable. But it is separate questions. You're not dying for the oligarchs, you're dying for survival of your people, your families, your loved ones. And experience, army is hard, obviously. There are a lot of Soviet elements, a lot of the elements that are not Soviet, but that are rising from government, a huge army. Armies that that obviously underfinanced, understaffed, and so on and so on, and which suffers under great pressure. So there are a lot of stuff that relates to it. Unfortunately, it happens, and I think it would be a situation for any army fighting the war on such scale. But I would say that the Ukrainian army holds better than would you expect. Fighting such major power and actually has a good chance of holding the line and surviving. And I would say that fighting as a Ukrainian left-wing person is something very important to me and actually to a lot of people who are from the left-wing views in the army. For all of them, it's both continuing the tradition of Ukrainian left-wing being on the front of the struggle for the prosperity of their own people, for the security of their own people, but also the way to show that the left wing is not connected to Russia, is not associated with the legacy of Soviet Union, but that it charts its own democratic way, its own way that doesn't align with Moscow.
That's perfect. Thank you, Vlad. And I think it's a perfect sort of transition as well into the next part of our discussion, which takes us back 100 years or more. And that is to look at, an earlier period in Ukraine's history when, again, it was trying to create not only self-determination, but a democratic socialist example for the world. And that is in the Ukrainian People's Republic of 1917. You've been writing about this, Vlad. Let me just reintroduce you to the audience in case they don't know. You are Vladislav Starobubtsev, is a Ukrainian left-wing activist. He's serving right now in the Ukrainian Armed Forces, but he's also a historian of Central Eastern Europe. And this is very much what we're going to be speaking about, is very much part of his historical work. Let's just try to get right into it and talk about what happened. Most of us think about 1917 as the revolution, and I've written a lot about this as well, as one of the pivotal events of the 20th century and the most progressive advance in human history to that time, when there was actual workers and peasants taking power in Russia. But most of us think about the rest of the Russian Empire as sort of following afterwards in conjunction with the Russian Revolution, but took a different path. So let's go back to 1917 and even earlier in Ukraine. And why don't you give us the sort of history from the February Revolution?
Okay, I will gladly do. I think history of Russian Revolution is too much portrayed as kind of history of Russians, of Russians doing something in relation with Russian state. But I think we really need to for understanding what was going on, to reconceptualize it as kind of not only revolution made by Russians, but also of Eastern European, Central Asian, and Asian springtime of nations. What was happening was a huge amount of self-determination and nations fighting for their own rights, for their self-determination, for practically the decolonization of Russian Empire. It was a revolution practically guided not even for ideas of modernity, but ideas of romantic nationalism, of progressivism of late 19th century, and especially under the influence of different Republican and Republican nationalist movements. This probably one of the closer example of left-wing in Italy, of Mazzini and others, who were trying to align both the ideas of national unity, democracy, fight against monarchy, all together with progressive and left-wing messaging. It was something that was happening throughout all the Russian Empire at the time. And it wasn't only for Ukrainians, it was for many nations. Many new states appeared first on the map, and many new nations first organized their political forces. It was not only Ukrainian People's Republic, it was Social Democratic Crimean People's Republic. It was Socialist Armenian Republic. It was also Socialist Georgian Democratic Republic. Even Bashkirs, Bukhara, all the Central Asian states. In Kazakhstan, there was a center-left state formed by the Kazakhs that was called Alash. It was autonomous province. So it was kind of huge revolt, all of the nations that were pissed from the monarchy and just completely dissatisfied from the war, hunger, poverty, and imperial rule. In this context, if we are speaking about the revolution as kind of springtime of nation, it started not in 1917, but in 1916 from the rebellion in Kazakhstan. And then it spread until the February 1917. And immediately after the establishment of provisional government in Ukraine, there forms its own provisional government called Ukrainian Central Rada. It wanted autonomy in Russian Republic, political self-governance, and it opposed more centralist approaches of Russian provisional government. It disagreed in many ways with the February Republic, which in its turn wanted to continue the war and continue allied obligations to Entente. Russian Republic also wanted to postpone land reform for the better time, and to kind of control the minorities and not allow too much autonomy for other provinces in newly formed Russian state. Because of this, there were immediately conflicts between Russian Republic and Ukrainian Central Rada. through these conflicts, Ukrainian forces organized and developed in kind of politically autonomous body. And it is important to say that Ukrainian struggle for self-determination and autonomy was led by socialist parties. It was completely left-wing struggle. It was Ukraine was a country of peasants and workers. Its representation was mainly by the free parties. It was Ukrainian Party of Socialist Revolutionaries, the biggest kind of this agrarian socialist party. Then there was Ukrainian Social Democratic Labor Party. It was a Marxist party that mostly organized workers. It was far smaller because there were so much...
This part of the history begins to coincide with what was happening within Russia as well, the Russian Empire, with the formation of the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party, as well as the SRs, the Socialist Revolutionaries. This point, was there coordination? Did they consider themselves part of this larger, you know, body that was meeting and then later split in the early period into the Bolsheviks and Mensheviks? How closely linked were the Ukrainians? And then there's also, of course, as we know, some of the most prominent Bolsheviks were Ukrainian Bolsheviks. Trotsky himself was born in Kherson province. And then you had Rakovsky and others. So at this point, was there much separation in their thinking about the revolution? Because they were internationalists after all?
There was actually, and separation was coming mostly from the both Bolsheviks and Mensheviks, who wanted to agitate in Ukraine in Russian language with disregard to specifically Ukrainian problems. Because of this, immediately both Mensheviks and Bolsheviks put themselves at odds with Ukrainian parts of social democratic movement. And it was boiling conflict that developed through years. It developed to the point that Lenin demanded for Ukrainian social democrats not to be included in international, in Second International, for the reason of principle of one social democratic party at one country. So he practically tried to kick Ukrainians out of international and force them to join Russian Social Democratic Labor Party. And there was a reason of conflict between Ukrainian social democracy and Russian social democracy. Because of this conflict, there wasn't much difference between Bolsheviks and Mensheviks from the eyes of Ukrainians, because Bolsheviks and Mensheviks had the same position in Ukraine. They had this very centralist approach, and Ukrainians wanted a more autonomous approach.
What years are we speaking about? Is this still in the period before the 1905 revolution, or is it leading up, you know, is this, we began by talking from February, but now you've gone back into the sort of formation.
Yeah, yeah.
So give us some time.
The conflict was from the formation of Russian social democracy. But it persisted through the time where social democracy split on Mensheviks and Bolsheviks. And after that, there was the situation after the revolution of 1905 about the Second International discussion and the one party, one social democratic party at one country. The same discussions also were, for example, in British Empire, where British socialists tried to suppress Indian ones by the same logic. So it's kind of a lot of different xenophobic and imperialist subtones of social democratic and Marxist and, in general, socialist movements at imperial course. So it was kind of a tendency. It wasn't something unique to Russia, but happened throughout the whole international.
This is just an incredible addition to our understanding of the period, but it also seems a little, I don't know, a little bit incongruent in a way, because, you know, I've studied this period a lot, and of course, Trotsky and Lenin and others were internationalists and, you know, set the stage for the big conflict. Lenin died, and then later, you know, when Stalin came to power, he was not an internationalist and considered, you know, the possibility, which was a fantasy, that you could build socialism in a single country through coercion. We don't need to go into that period, but in this earlier period, are you suggesting in a way that they were all imbued with this kind of Russian chauvinism, even though they wouldn't want to admit to it?
Absolutely. I would say that far more than usual historiography puts light on it, especially Lenin, far less Trotsky, but Lenin, yeah. He had this idea of while he was criticizing Russian chauvinism as cultural practice, politically, he was very centralist. He wasn't gonna let any autonomy to any other nations. He wanted unified Russian state. In terms of political power, all the Russian state power would later be in the hands of Communist Party. In terms of cultural autonomy, he was in opposition to more chauvinist approaches and so on and so on, but he still was chauvinist in terms of political question. And I would say economically too. Fortunately, there is little discussion about this, but the politics of earlier Bolsheviks in Ukraine, even at that time, were very similar to Stalinist policies later, but they were in their more earlier states. For example, there was hunger in Ukraine that was triggered by Russian Bolsheviks extracting the grain from Ukraine to Russia without any
compensation. This is in the 1930s, you mean?
No. It was in 1920s.
Oh, yeah, that's right, during the Civil War. So just for the listeners, let me just say, this is right after the successful revolution, there was probably 6 good months, I call it the golden era, in which the Bolsheviks attempted to create the most democratic revolutionary experience in human history. But the new reality was that they were invaded by many armies and from the whites from within. There was a nearly 3-year civil war that dashed all of the hopes, and we call it a defeat in victory because the Bolsheviks prevailed, but everything revolutionary about it was crushed and they had to begin again. And there was famine at this point and requisitioning where, you know, the Red Army had to go to the countryside and demand their grain in order to feed the soldiers at the front, etc. So take it from there.
I would disagree with this view of the Bolsheviks. Because from the start, it was a very vanguard power. It wanted to centralize forces, and it immediately started from the October, repressing all their political rivals, who were mostly workers and peasant parties. PSR, Mensheviks, and many Ukrainian socialists were first friendly with Bolsheviks. They saw it as a great push for workers, international workers, world revolution, and so on and so on. But immediately, they were not welcomed, but faced with declaration of war.
That Before was, we get into the declaration of war, can we just stay for a moment? Yeah, I want to get into it. But
start chronologically, so it would be more understandable.
Yeah, and I want to interject there, too, that at the time of the victory of the Russian Revolution, and this is something that Putin holds against Lenin as well, is that they did issue in their early proclamations the Declaration of the Rights of the Peoples of Russia, which guaranteed equality and sovereignty, the right of self-determination, including the right to separate and form independent states as Finland did. And then, of course, abolition of Russian religious privileges, free development of all national and ethnic minorities, and even an appeal to the Islamic workers of Russia in the East to take their customs and organize in their own way and become the masters of their own country. So Lenin said something famously like, your destiny is in your hands. But quickly, as you're starting to say, this changed. And I think this is a really important point to bring out, because Victor Serge, the guy who I write about, said about those who thought that the Bolsheviks wanted from the beginning to create a centralized party state and a bureaucratic one. Serge said no one ever thought of fighting for a totalitarian state. Men fought and died for a new kind of freedom. So let's take it back then into what the reality was, as you see it in your historical investigation in Ukraine.
I would say that in terms of Bolshevik Party, most of them were honest people fighting for their beliefs, but they're also leadership, and there are also a lot of different, I would say, stereotypes and chauvinism that was presented in all of the Russian parties, which all influenced the situation. When October Revolution happened, Ukraine declared Ukrainian People's Republic, and it completely took practically all the self-governance. And together with Bolshevik forces, they forced out the provisional government forces that tried to use Ukraine as kind of this platform of counter-revolution.
And was this still in 1918 that you're speaking about?
Yes, it was in October, November.
So right after the revolution?
Yes.
Even as they're making these proclamations?
Just immediately after the revolution, there were attempts to immediately work together with the revolutionary government in Russia. And there were also coalitions between local Bolsheviks and Ukrainian socialists against all of those who tried to reinstate the old previous government. Together, these forces, they acted as security of the revolution, defense of the revolution, and so on and so on. But immediately after the forces of provisional government were disarmed, Bolshevik forces tried to overthrow newly established Ukrainian government. They were disarmed by Ukrainians after that. And after that, Bolsheviks sent the ultimatum to Ukrainians in December 1917 that demanded practically abolition of Ukrainian autonomy, giving Russia authority on number of political decisions in Ukraine. And otherwise, if Ukrainian government wouldn't comply, declaration of war.
What did this mean for those Ukrainian revolutionaries who were Bolsheviks? Did they then become disaffected and leave and side with the developing Ukrainian revolution? Or did they then sacrifice for the larger picture, as well, they often did to fight for the survival of the Russian Revolution? What happened?
It was different from person to person. But most interestingly, Ukrainian Bolsheviks weren't consulted on the decision. They discovered the ultimatum the day where all Ukraine discovered it. It was a very awkward situation for them because it was the same time where there was Workers' Congress in Ukraine itself, and they were presented there. They actually had some position there and some influence. But after the declaration became known, it was a declaration from Moscow. Ukrainian Bolsheviks didn't participate in this ultimatum.
I'm presuming you're talking about the new Central Rada, which was the parliament in Ukraine. What were the divisions there and how did that debate unfold?
First, it formed as a group of intellectuals. Then it organized congresses to legitimize itself and find its representation. First, it organized national congress of kind of national organizations, municipalities, then peasants, cooperatives, workers, and soldiers. And they all elected representatives to the Central Rada, to this kind of provisional government of Ukraine. And on the workers' congress, there was presented this ultimatum, which Ukrainian Bolsheviks were not informed before and not participated in the discussion. So it put them in a really awkward position because they didn't know what's going on. Most of them just was completely shocked at this development and were against it, but tried to defend party line. And some of them just didn't believe what was going on. So it was complete confusion. And of course, after this ultimatum became public, Workers' Congress in absolute majority supported Ukrainian Central Rada and practically kicked Bolshevik representatives from the Congress.
But you see in this period that that Ukraine was already declaring itself as an independent republic, right? And a new nation.
Yes.
And at the same time, well, maybe you could answer this. Did they see it as completely separate or part of with autonomy, political and cultural autonomy? For those, you know, let's say, because you're talking about a really democratic socialist program that was being debated and trying to be implemented in revolutionary Ukraine. So how did they see themselves then in relation to Russia?
First, as it was declared, it was declared as a federative republic in a larger Russian republic. But their vision for Russia was different from centralized vision of Russian Federation, and it more sampled of kind of as European Union right now. So something of like loose confederation of different states, of different people of Russia on democratic basis. But with time, I would say Ukrainians got disillusioned with this idea, and they rather developed the conception that Ukraine should separate from Russia and become independent state completely, and that if there would be a possible federation in future, it should be federation of all of the world after the workers' revolution, and that should strive for this type of federation and not federation with Russia. And in this world federation, that they should come as equals, between equals, which they fought at that moment that couldn't be achieved in participating in Russian state because of Russian chauvinism.
The Central Rada at this point was the backbone of it. Soviets, as you saw in Russia,
yes,
you talked about
yes.
the cooperatives, but were they also councils in the same way?
Exactly.
And then did it differ from the way that the Soviets existed in Russia in this revolutionary period?
It was a very similar situation. In Ukraine, majority of Soviets were peasants and soldiers.
Which was workers, the majority of the population in any
yes,
case.
Yes, exactly. workers were, of course, far lesser part of population. And workers and peasant Soviets, they were around 60% of all of the representatives of Central Rada. But Central Rada itself, it was majority Soviet, but not Soviet parliament as a whole. It was different social groups. And
I just have to ask one more question, too, just about the map. At that point, was the map of Ukraine at that time the same as the map that we saw in 1991 of the territory? Because, you know, we know right now that the most contested area is the Donbass, and the Donbass is the industrial heartland where you had all the mining and all the engineering and steel and everything else. And it was also a period that was settled by Russian workers early, very early, at the end of the 19th century as the push for industrialization began. So what was the Donbass like in that period? And was I'm making you go further afield than perhaps your paper does, but I want to bring it in so that we can have this comparison.
There's this myth of Russian Donbass and as kind of this separate identity from Ukraine. But in fact, Donbass at the time was not very different from the rest of Ukraine. The first workers' kind of cooperation between the regions in Ukraine happened between the most western parts of Ukraine in the Lviv region in Galicia and between Donbass. Because Donbass was industrial heartland with mines, and Galicia was a kind of industrial heartland with oil fields.
And Galicia is western Ukraine, for people who don't know the geography.
And because of this, there were a lot of experience that was very similar for west and east, but central Ukraine couldn't understand because of lack of this industrial mining capacities and drills. So there were a lot of these connections. And Ukraine as a whole had very strong urban divide. Urban centers were all non-Ukrainian. They were Russian, they were Polish, they were Jewish. There weren't much of the cities that were Ukrainian majority. Even Kyiv was majority Russian. But all of the agrarian side, all of the countryside was Ukrainian. So because of that, the cities were kind of stronghold of Russian influence. Usually it was 70% of the population were Ukrainians from the countryside, and 30% were all everyone else from the cities. So there were these divides, and it was the same for the Donbass. So Russian workers were in the cities, but Ukrainians were on the countryside. But it wasn't unique for the Donbass. It was throughout Ukraine. Ukrainian borders were farther to the east than it's now, but it didn't include Crimea because Crimea self-determined as state of Crimean Tatars. So it wasn't included in Ukrainian borders at that time.
At this time, right. So maybe now let's walk through the progressive reforms that were instituted in this early Ukrainian People's Republic, as you've started to describe. And can you talk a little bit about those reforms in the economy and in, let's say, in the burgeoning democracy?
I think the most exciting thing about Ukrainian People's Republic is that it was majorly cooperative governed. So economy was organized by the cooperatives. It wasn't complete control of the economy, but around 70% of Ukrainian population were part of cooperatives. So 70% of Ukrainian economy were cooperative run, and other 30% were state or private run. So around the time, on the start of the revolution, 70% of Ukrainian economy already organized on this social basis. Ukraine was also one of the first countries to kind of introduce proto-Keynesian policies of social spending and social financial policies that were developed by Ukrainian Ministry of Finance. It also introduced strong representation for workers and peasants. At one point of history, in the late period of Ukrainian People's Republic, it outlawed participation of bourgeoisie and landlords in politics completely. So the parliament of Ukraine at the later stage of the revolution was absolutely 100% workers, peasants, and intelligentsia. And it was formed from not just usual universal parliament, but more of the kind of social representation of different social groups. There were seats for different social groups. For example, workers had like X amount of seats, peasant Y amount of seats, and intelligentsia Z amount of seats.
So they had this democratic participation, and you already mentioned, Vlad, about the sort of proto-Keynesian approach, which seemed realistic given the development of capitalism at a very early stage in the entire Russian Empire, but probably in Ukraine as well. And I think you mentioned Tukhan Baranovsky's approach and being very important in this. But like, and you're just starting to discuss the actual, let's say, power that the peasantry and working class could hold in this new Ukrainian People's Republic. Can you just talk a little bit more about that and how that would clash perhaps in this somewhat, you know, Keynesian in the sense of, I'm presuming, large role for the state, but still having private ownership? Maybe you could just elaborate a little bit.
Private ownership was practically, even in the Bolshevik parts of Russia, of empire, of Bolshevik-controlled parts, was still in place, mostly because there weren't just enough people who understood how to run the businesses, who had the education, practically. Most of the Ukraine were illiterate. There were problems in terms of education, in terms of engineers, in terms of administrators, managers, and so on and so on. So in the immediate solution of questions like hunger and poverty, there were a lot of compromises with people who understood how to run things. In some ways, private ownership was secured. In other places, cooperative ownership took over. In some places, mostly in military-related industries, complete state takeover of the industry. So it was more case by case, but around 70% of the economy was cooperative run, and everything else was relatively equally distributed between the state and private ownership.
That's all we have time for today, but we will play this entire interview at another time. But for now, here are some closing remarks near the end of our conversation. To listen to this interview in its entirety, tune into Jacobin Radio, wherever you get your podcasts, available by midweek. So my last question to you, Vlad, is what lessons this early experiment in an absolutely radical revolutionary form would have for the contemporary left, not just in Ukraine, but around the world, as you just said, as an example of decentralized, democratic, cooperative socialism. And in fact, it resonates not just, you know, in Ukraine, let's say, and I want to ask about how it resonates in today's Ukraine, but also, you know, with these anti-neoliberal movements around the world, let's say in the United States, in Britain now with this new party. Everywhere, you could tie this together and maybe say in some ways that Ukrainian socialists and anarchists and revolutionaries, you know, in the 1920s show the kind of example. But how would
it is an example that another world is possible. It is actually something that I believe people on the left all around the world should look into, because it's something that was not imagined, not theoretical, but extremely practical, put forward and realized a century ago. So now with new experiences, new realities, and new technologies, new politics, and so on, there are even more possibilities to realize progressive projects. Right now, nearly all of the people around the globe, well, most of them, can read. At that time, it wasn't the case, and still such great changes were possible, still even in democratic spirit. So there are a lot of things to learn. At the same time, it is also an example not only of progressive change, but also of progressive anti-colonial change. And right now where we see so many tankies, so many people who are trying to divide on the basis of nation, on the political basis and social basis, we have an example where all of these components worked together, where there was national liberation from imperial, from the empire, when there was social liberation from capitalism and political liberation from the monarchy. All the struggles against authoritarian rules, against imperialism and against capitalism were united. And great examples could be learned from this, especially in hard times of today's, where we see rise of authoritarian dictators, neoliberals, and so on, and imperialism, of course.
Vlad Starobubtsev, I can't thank you enough for this discussion. I've been speaking with Vladislav Starobubtsev. He is an historian, he's an activist, and he's also a soldier at the front in this horrible war that Putin has imposed on Ukraine. And we've been talking about not only the summit today in Alaska that may lead to a temporary pause in the war, but also about the Ukrainian People's Republic, a short-lived and, as you've listened, an extraordinary experiment in democratic socialism built by the early Ukrainian revolutionaries at the heart of the 1917 Revolutionary Wave. And just to summarize super quickly, the Ukrainian People's Republic was committed to peasant and worker power organized through cooperatives. And there were things that we didn't even mention, like gender equality and the rights of national minorities. And I encourage the listeners to read much more about this, because as Vlad just said, it allows us to think about another world that is possible. And here it allows us to imagine a socialism without empire that is rooted in democracy, equality, and self-determination. And this couldn't be more important than right now at this time when Ukraine is fighting not just for its sovereignty, but it has this history that reminds us the struggle against Russian imperialism in this case, and for a just cooperative society, has very, very deep roots. And even remembering it, I think you might agree, Vlad, is an act of resistance. And I want to thank you so much for sharing that with us today.
Thank you for listening. Have a good day.
You too. And that's our show for today. I'd like to thank my guest, Vladislav Starobubtsev. Thanks to executive producer Robert Brenner, producer-director Melissa Figueroa, editor-engineer Juliana Gota, and Osman Flamenco in Master Control. You can listen to this and other archive shows, as well as subscribe to the podcast at kpfk.org. Click Audio Archives and scroll down to Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. More information on programs and guests are on our Facebook page. That's Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. You can also listen to an extended version of this program on Jacobin Radio, available wherever you listen to your podcast. You've been listening to Beneath the Surface on KPFK, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond, streaming live and archived at kpfk.org. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support. Stay tuned now for Ian Masters and Background Briefing. I'm Susie Wiseman.
Black August is a month-long commemoration dedicated to honoring Black freedom fighters and political prisoners, particularly those that have been killed or imprisoned due to their activism and resistance against systemic oppression. It originated in the 1970s within California prisons and has since spread to communities, becoming a time for reflection, study, and recommitment to the fight for Black liberation. KPFK Radio stands in solidarity with Black August, which serves as a reminder of the ongoing struggle for Black liberation and the importance of honoring those who have fought for freedom, past, present, and future.
Support comes from the Festival of Tabla, where music transcends boundaries and hearts find their rhythm. It's taking place Saturday, August 16th, and Sunday, August 17th, at the Soca Performing Arts Center in Aliso Viejo, California, from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. both days. This year, all performances and engaging workshops are offered as a dedication to the life and legacy of Ustad Zakir Hussain. Further information and tickets are available at festivaloftabla.com and kpfk.org.
Donate donate your used car, truck, or boat to the KPFK Vehicle Donation Program. It's an easy way to help support KPFK and receive a tax deduction. All you have to do is call 877-KPFK-AUTO. An operator will arrange a good time to pick up your vehicle. 877-KPFK-AUTO or go online to kpfk.org.
La agencia ICE está intensificando las operaciones de